Say what you need to say, Josh. Get it off your chest.
How long do we have?
They can tell you not only the position of a pitcher's elbow, so flexion, extension, how they bend their elbow, as well as how fast they're moving it.
Early in his career, he was pretty much holding it in the middle, and it was a very awkward to swing because he kept hitting himself with the end of it. But now he handles the bat well. And welcome once again to Artificial Turf Wars, Episode 6, where running headfirst into the wall is an art form. I'm Greg Wisniewski, and I'm joined tonight by my friend Joshua Housam. How's it going, Josh?
Not so bad. How about you?
I forgot to have a clever adjective for you this week. I was busy with other things, but next week for sure. I'm doing well.
So disappointed.
We are going to talk tonight about the last signing out of spring, Franklin Morales, which, yeah, the timing on that was interesting for us. Just it's a personal thing. Then we're going to actually talk about baseball games that mattered. Some highlights, low lights. John Gibbons forgot how to manage a bullpen. We'll go into some depth about that. And then ex-Blue Jay David Price was supposed to face the Blue Jays, but is not. We will tell you why if you can't figure it out for yourself. Then we're going to talk to biomechanist Thomas Karakolis about all kinds of different issues with keeping players on the field and healthy. We're going to take listener questions. We're going to give John Gibbons a do-over, even though the real regular media tried to give him a do-over. And we're going to talk about the cliche of the week, which we haven't had for a while. He handles the bat well. Rewind all the way.
Spoiling it early.
Well, yeah. People can think about that now. Does he handle the bat well? Doesn't he? So, Franklin Morales. You were a little upset at the timing of the Franklin Morales signing because it kept intact a long tradition around here at ATW.
Yep. Once again, our podcast was obsolete within a day of release. I mean, this one was just, we were breaking down the opening day roster. How did that happen?
25 men, one of whom is wrong.
No, I think this time it's just because they listened to us about how Ryan DePera might not be the lefty killer that people think.
Right. Yeah, we probably should not have revealed that clever detail, because that obviously spurred into action the powers that be. Is Franklin Morales the lefty killer that we need in the bullpen?
He's legit. I was actually very surprised that the Jays got him. By the way, I can't believe I just called DePera by that name.
Oh, so not Pat Venditti isn't on the team anymore. Well, you can call him that because he's not taking Pat Venditti's spot anymore.
That's true. He's earned his name back.
The things you got to do around here.
Yeah, exactly. Last year, Morales was quite good for Kansas City. He had a 3.18 ERA in 67 appearances, and he destroyed lefties. Righties actually hit him very well. 284, 371, 466, 837 OPS. But lefties were 209, 287, 324 against him. So as a second lefty in the pen, it's actually really valuable.
He is the loogie in training. For those of you, lefty only one out guy?
That's it.
But why is there a Y on loogie?
Because they put the Y at the end of guy instead of a G. So just loog.
Loog. So yeah, thank you for signing Franklin Morales. He makes good business sense, but you ruined what was a wonderful 25-man roster breakdown. Okay, we played, we
one
watched.
Second, just before we move on, yep. We should probably talk about his contract. It's kind of quirky. So he's getting 1 year, $2 million, but it's non-guaranteed, which probably makes no sense to most people. But basically what it means is if after 45 days, the full amount becomes guaranteed. But if they release him before that or send him to the minors, well, they can't. He's out of options. But if they get rid of him before that, they only have to pay the prorated amount.
The weird part is I read Matt Gwynn put up all of the pertinent parts of the CBA about non-guaranteed contracts, and it was very difficult to find the sentence that talked about the 45 days without also seeing sentences that talked about as soon as he got put on the major league roster after spring training or before open. If he got put on the roster before opening day, it was all guaranteed, and if this happened, it was guaranteed, and if this happened, it was guaranteed, and there's like one exception where it's not guaranteed if he's on the team on opening day. It was really strange. I'm like, this is the weirdest contract language ever, to get this one stipulation in there that you could cut him if you needed to.
Yeah. Baseball CBA is very goofy.
It's very long. The longer a legal document gets, the weirder it gets.
Pretty much a general rule, yeah.
So let's not talk about legal documents anymore. Let's talk about baseball. I will let you start by just gushing over the Marcus Stroman 8-plus innings to begin the season. I assume you want to do that.
Oh, man. Marcus Stroman, you know, when the season started, I was talking about, I think it was in the last podcast, that I'm not sure the Jays should be counting on him to be an ace just because he's never done it before.
Now, did I tell you you were wrong?
Yeah, I think you did. Yeah, well, mea culpa. He was really, really good.
He was awesome. He was dealing.
Like, oh, 74 strikes, 24 balls.
Yeah, and
he only fell behind in the count 5 times.
Just crazy.
Oh, sorry, ended.
Ended with behind it. Yeah. Ended in a bat behind in the count.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at that pitch track where those balls are, if he's looking for ground balls. And remember, he was not drafted as a ground ball pitcher. He was drafted as a fly ball pitcher, and that was one of the concerns. And he's completely turned that around with changing his pitch mix and selection. And there was so much in the lower half of the zone. It was unreal.
Oh, yeah. I think we did this rotation review, which broke down all of the starts. And Steve did this one. 62 of his 98 pitches were in the lower half of the zone. That's crazy.
And a guy who made a career out of that was Roy Halladay to a ridiculous amount. So, I mean, if you're going to emulate anybody, trying to keep the ball on the ground, trying to, and again, with control, he has great control for a guy of his age and level of amount of experience. It's crazy that he's painting corners like that. So, woo, Marcus Stroman.
Well, and it was just funny because so he's doing all this stuff, getting all these ground ball outs, quick outs. His counterpart, Chris Archer, struck out 12 batters, but only lasted 5 innings because he threw 107 pitches.
One of the worst looking 12 strikeout performances I have watched / heard of, in terms of he didn't know where the ball was going. But no, they couldn't really hit it very well. Like, the combination was odd, especially for an opening day start when a guy is usually, more or less, you're expecting him to be on his game one way or another. But yeah, he was all over the place.
Yeah, hanging a lot of sliders that the Jays just happened to be swinging through.
And that happened, actually, the pitch count thing happened almost the whole series long. With the exception of Dickey, who had to keep wiggling off the hook in game 2, I looked a whole bunch of times in the third or fourth inning, and the Rays starting pitcher would have 89, 92 pitches, and the Jays pitcher would have 54. And I was like, this is crazy, because the Jays struck out like mad the whole series long.
Oh my God, they set a franchise record for strikeouts in a 4-game series.
It felt like it.
46 strikeouts in a 4-game series.
Like, it was just insane. The amount of whiffs and takes and everything else. And they didn't, they just could not put the ball in play. And even when they, and then, of course, when they put it in play, they hit a bunch of home runs. That was their only real offense. It was so, it's only 4 games, thank God. But it's a very, very strange way to start with a sample in the year. And do you blame Ray's pitching? Do you blame the Trop? Like,
when you consider how, oh yeah, like I said, they swung through a lot of hanging sliders. I think that the Jays hitters were just—I don't know if it was like just going back and forth all the stadiums in spring training at the end there with Montreal, Tampa, Dunedin, or if it's just, you know, early season stuff. It's hard to say, but they were definitely missing some very hittable pitches and taking some pitches that were right there.
Yeah, the thing seemed definitely out of sync, and they paid in K's. It was like the currency of the day. But a lot of guys who we were maybe a little worried about got on the board when they weren't striking out. Josh Donaldson, despite whiffing like crazy, he homered twice in the series, didn't he?
Did he get? Yes, he did.
Yeah, he did. And then, yeah. Of course, on the second home run, he hurt himself.
Yes, he did. He apparently had some calf issue, which he developed in Montreal. Stupid Montreal series injuring our players. It's Jose Reyes the first time. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's supposed to be back for the home opener, which is tonight, if you're listening to this, on the day we release.
Ooh. Normally we talk about the day we record, but
I know. I'm trying to change things up.
I'm confused.
This reminds me. I put out a poll on Twitter today. Just, I asked, who do people think would be the most disastrous loss for the Blue Jays? Who do you think is winning? I gave three choices and an other. Donaldson, Stroman, Martin, and other. Other has 3%, so it's one of the three guys.
Martin would have been my answer only based on what you guys have taught me, but I could see why Donaldson would be number one in people's mind.
No, Martin has 45% of the vote.
Yeah. But Donaldson has a similar depth-ish problem. Like, if there's two guys who get hurt who you can't plug any useful parts in right away, those are the two guys, right?
I think so. I mean, Stroman, obviously he's awesome, but if he gets hurt, then it's just Hutchison comes in, or Chavez or Floyd. They have starting pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Donaldson, I think it depends on what you think of Andy Burns, right? Andy Burns, if he's good, then it wouldn't be a huge loss, but can't really count on that. I was just very curious to see how the fan base would react, because Martin, it's like you're dropping to Toley and Sanchez, and that would be very bad.
I think what happens for the starting pitching role is if you lose Stroman, you go to a league average starter, potentially. One of those guys is going to come up probably exactly. And be average. Whereas if you lose Donaldson or Martin, you go to replacement level unless you get really, really, really lucky.
Or worse, in the case of the catchers.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, this is a steep drop off. Now, you besmirched Josh Tolle, and Josh Tolle already has more home runs than Jose Bautista.
He already has more home runs than Josh Tolle did in 2015 and 2014.
It's not fair to compare him to himself.
And he almost didn't get it. The umpires rooted a double at first.
That's Laz Diaz, man. Laz Diaz should have just gone home. Well, generally, I think he should go home. But that night, was everything that went wrong, Laz Diaz was there. Foul ball appeal call. Laz Diaz is signaling out, and the other guy is signaling foul. It's like,
And he had a terrible strike zone in the fourth game of the series.
Mm-hmm.
He's just bad. And then it's obviously, there was the play that ended the game, but we should start with how that one began. Aaron Sanchez. Oh, yeah. My. Like, you talk about gushing over Stroman. I want to gush over Aaron Sanchez.
Say what you need to say, Josh. Get it off your chest.
How long do we have?
I'm guessing not long enough. We cannot go pitch by pitch.
Oh, fine. Okay, so I'll just give you some pertinent stats. Okay, so Aaron Sanchez, in his career, his first pitch strike percentage is 53%. In that game, it was 69%. Don't say it.
Fine.
His career swing and miss rate is 18%. In that game, it was 32.7%. He didn't walk a batter. He struck out eight.
Yeah. For those of you who don't really look at statistics a lot in terms of swing rates and whiff rates and all that other stuff, to go from 18 to 32 is to change from a contact-oriented ground ball pitcher to
Clayton Kershaw.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which is ridiculous.
He just absolutely dominated them. I had high hopes for Sanchez, as I've mentioned a few times on this podcast, but even I would never have expected him to come out like that. I mean, everything he did was just on point. His fastball was harder somehow, too, as a starter. And a mile per hour harder than it was last year, including his time in the pen. And on Mike Son, who has appeared on this podcast, on his stuff metric.
It's a big, sharp, upward-tilted line on Aaron Sanchez's stuff.
Yes, there is. His stuff rating would have been the third highest in all of baseball last year, just if it was that one start. That's how good he was in that game.
So now,
I mean, obviously it's one game, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's unpredictable.
But what a game.
Oh yeah, exactly. But it just shows what he can do.
Yeah.
Right. Right. There's always the worry for, it's like, oh, he can't miss bats. Well, he can miss bats.
Yeah. If you get everything working, well, he's wearing the big boy 20 extra pounds pants. And I think there's the way he's using that extra weight, whether it's part mental or you know, completely physical, whichever, it's obviously working for him in terms of both stamina and with his ability to control his mechanics. So,
yeah, and he was also using all his pitches too. He threw a bunch of changeups, which is a pitch that wasn't really a thing for him last year.
Yeah. So what can we keep it up?
I mean, if he can keep doing anything close to that, I mean, if he keeps pitching like that, he's going to win the Cy Young. if he just pitches, you know, three quarters of that, he's exactly what we need.
Exactly. Okay. I think we've spent enough time on game reviews because we do have to cover. Oh, well, but we have to talk about the end of
that game.
Yeah, we do. Okay. So the umpires went to review. The Jays went from up 4-3, scoring two runs on an error, to I'm sorry you lost, which was that is the quickest gut punch I've ever had at the end of a baseball game. Like, I was literally, I look at my wife and I'm like, what?
Yeah, I was fist pumping, and then it's like, oh, then I saw the replay. It's like, oh no, they're gonna reverse this. No. And then they reversed it.
Yeah. So a lot of people complaining right off the bat, Bautista's slide was this and it was that and it wasn't this, and if you read the rule, he did two things wrong, one of which was he came out of his slide to try and make contact with the fielder, and the second one was, and it's clear at the end, Bautista is not in contact nor attempting to make contact with the bag. He's turning around and he's looking at what happens at first base, which is no longer allowed. Now,
that's why I thought it was going to get overturned. I didn't think that the thing where he touched his foot was that big. But he didn't. He went through the bag, and we've already seen that twice. That if you don't do that, it's a double play.
Yeah, and the only weird part I find about that part of the rule, and I understand that that's how it's written. So again, kudos to the umpires; they called it as written. I don't have a problem with that. I'm curious as to what the rule is achieving. So once you're out, do you just sit on the bag until all play has stopped?
No, the point is so that the guys don't slide really hard, really late.
Right, so you're within...
Because if you slide early enough, your momentum will stop you.
On the bag.
Or close enough to the bag that you can still reach it.
You could have argued that Bautista could have reached it in that case.
But he wasn't trying to, which is why... Yeah.
Because he knew he was out.
Yeah,
so his instincts tell him, don't bother reaching for the bag, you're out already.
It's funny, if he had reached back for the bag, I wonder if they would have overturned, if they would have changed the... called it a double play, because the contact with the foot was so innocuous that if he was only breaking that, I bet it's the score stands and the Jays win the game.
So the problem I have is that there are a bunch of the unintended consequences of this rule. The rule is designed to prevent injury. There was no chance of injury with anything that happened the way he slid, and he did slide differently, he admitted, than he would have in a previous year, right?
He would have broken Forsyth's leg in a previous year. He put himself in a really dangerous position with his back leg just hanging out there.
Yeah. So we've achieved something. Forsyth is still upright, but we've done it by this really strange method that creates
automatic double plays.
Yeah. So how long before second basemen figure out how close they can hang to the bag and get the automatic double play, even if they make a lousy throw?
Oh, I think that's going to happen really fast.
Exactly. So was that the intention of the rule?
Clearly no.
So here we go. So,
although it benefits Devin Travis if he ever comes back, because I thought he was going to get killed with how he hangs in on double plays.
So we'll see what they do with the rule. They have changed the home plate lane rule. They have changed the tag rule regarding whether on instant replay, whether it was just the laces or the actual glove. And they have changed what constitutes in the glove as far as, is it just in the pocket or is it made contact with the leather on instant replay? They've changed all of those things after instituting the rules and in the middle of a season.
Yeah, once they watch it and say, oh, this was not a good idea.
So this rule, again, I would rather have it happen, I said it on Twitter, but I'll say it again, in game 3 for the Blue Jays than in game 163 for anybody.
Yes. No, I agree with that completely. I think anybody would be crazy to disagree. Or just
all
the
you crazy people
ever.
Okay. The last thing about this series, Gibbons and his bullpen management in game 4. They say managers can lose you more games than they can win you.
He lost that.
Yep.
It was just baffling. I don't understand. I mean, look, Drew Storen, unavailable, which you can say what you want about whether he should have been. He was. But how on earth are you going to Arnold Leon with runners on base in a one-run game in the eighth?
When you have Roberto Osuna, who was rested a day from the previous night. And
has a day off the next day.
Has a day off the next day. And you only need 5 outs. And who knows? You might not need him for the last 3. You might need him for these 2, and the Jays could score.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side, you even have Joe Biagini.
Just keep Gavin Floyd in the game. The only also, 2 base runners that got on were off the end of the bat singles, and he had 3 strikeouts.
So maybe Gibbons has learned his lesson, because people like to learn lessons from small sample size results, and a big Steven Sousa jack.
Huge. He crushed that. So Leon, who we were like, well, we don't know much about this guy. He comes in and immediately falls behind 3-0. It's like, oh boy.
Welcome to the Blue Jays.
And then he throws a strike and just serves up the meatiest pitch you've ever seen. And Sousa did what you're supposed to do with those.
Yeah. So
there was actually another bullpen thing that happened in the game earlier. I'll let you say what you're going to say, but then I want to get to that.
Sorry, I was just going to say Steven Sousa is going to be a thorn in our side now, because was that 3 home runs in the series for him? It felt like it.
Yeah, he had a good series.
Except for defensively. The dive on Bautista's triple was the funniest dive I have seen in years.
He was within 5 feet of the ball.
5? He wasn't even within 10. It was like, I'm going to leap now. There's probably a ball out here. Like, what?
Did you see Odorizzi's reaction when he did it?
Well, I can't repeat what he said. So, yes, yeah. I did.
Yes, you did then. Just had no idea what was going on.
Oh, man.
But anyway, the other bullpen thing I was going to talk about, and actually I have a piece coming out about this on BP Toronto Friday morning. This concept that the long reliever has to come in as the first reliever out of the pen if it's before the 5th is crazy.
Yeah. It always has been.
In the 4th inning, Hap had bases loaded and a run in with 1 out. And the guy that's getting up was Biagini, who hasn't pitched above AA in his career. How are you not going to Floyd?
Because he knew he needed Floyd for later.
Yeah.
My take on that has always been the very simple logic. Relievers used to be called firemen because they used to come in to put out the fire. So when you have a big fire, bring in the quickest fireman and don't worry about later, because the fire will be out then.
Yeah. What lead do you have to protect later if you're going to blow it now?
Your middle reliever usually brings a gas can with him just in case.
Or your long reliever brings like gunpowder.
So there you go. We have talked about this way too long. So quickly, yep. David Price.
Yeah, so for people who are going to the game on Sunday, it was supposed to be David Price against Marco Estrada, which would have been a lot of fun. It's not going to be that anymore. The Red Sox got rained out on Thursday. Yeah, they played 2 games. They were there for 5 days. But they got rained out on Thursday. So now the Blue Jays will face Joe Kelly, Rick Porcello, and Stephen Wright in the 3-game series.
And as admittedly as any of those guys can be good on a given night, I keep thinking, and these guys were picked as favorites for the division by a bunch of people. And those are
and also, like, if you're John Farrell, how are you not skipping one of those guys and just using Price anyway?
I don't understand. All right. While we think about all the things we don't understand, we're going to try and expand our knowledge by talking to biomechanist Thomas Karakolis.
There you go.
Formerly of the University of Waterloo. He has a PhD, so hopefully he will make us a little bit smarter. We'll be right back with him after this. And we are joined tonight, once again, by injury biomechanist Thomas Karakolis, one time of the University of Waterloo. How are you, Thomas?
I'm well. How about you guys?
I'm excellent.
Good, thanks.
So, welcome back. It's been almost a year since we talked. We talked a lot about injuries and repetitive stress problems and innings limits last time. It was kind of an unfinished conversation. So, much to our surprise, the Blue Jays this year under the new regime have come up with something they call the high performance department, which seems to be a sort of a holistic approach that includes a lot of those ideas that we talked about trying to take care of the individual. Well, I understand that you've heard of some of the people in the department before. I just want to get your take on what they seem to be doing.
Yeah, I've been following it mostly just in the news, like I guess any Jays fan has been, but I think they hired Angus Mugford last December, but I didn't actually read about it until January. I think it was either the Globe or the Star ended up writing a whole article about it. And since then, they've hired a whole team around him that they're the high performance department for the Toronto Blue Jays front office. Yeah.
Now, those people are known sort of in your industry as having some... you were saying, I think we talked via email, you're saying some more of a psychology background, but some of the other ones have other specialties?
Yeah, so truthfully, I actually didn't know any of them before the Jays hired them. Their background, so Angus's background looks like it's in sports psychology. So he does PhD work in the U.S., but he's a Brit, and I think they brought a few Brits in, actually, so... Their backgrounds appear to be kind of rugby soccer-ish, which is kind of cool and interesting. But in terms of the baseball world, I hadn't heard of them. My background's a little different too, so that explains it as well. I'm not a sports psychologist. I look at injury biomechanics and strength and conditioning performance type stuff. The deputy director, Clive Brewer, is that man's name, and he's a strength and conditioning guy, so he's someone that's interesting, and it seems encouraging that they brought him on board as the deputy director, which is something I think is going to be good for the Jays, because we kind of talked about this before, Greg. The Jays don't their problem to me hasn't seemed to been between the players' heads. It hasn't been like a psychology type of thing. They've in the past had a lot of problems just staying healthy, so. From that strength and conditioning type of perspective and the idea of recovery time and tailoring everyone's workouts, their workloads, as well as their recovery time, that's where I think this is really going to pay dividends for the Jays, what they've done here.
Just given what you just said, are you surprised that the head of the department, they went the psychology route as opposed to someone with a biomechanics background?
No, I wouldn't say that because it's baseball. So I guess... No, I'm not really surprised because it's baseball and a lot of what goes on in the game of baseball goes on between your head. So sports psychology is extremely important. So I understand that the emphasis of the department's on that. So that makes complete sense to me. There's a lot of preparation time and you spend more time, I guess, not doing stuff during baseball and thinking about doing stuff than actually doing it. So sports psychology is very important, but once I read on Sportsnet's site that they ended up hiring Clive Brewer as like a strength conditioning guy, I was really encouraged by that because I think for the Jays in particular, that's really important to keep their guys healthy.
Well, I mean, on that note, the keeping the guys healthy, there's also the part of how you keep guys on the field who haven't gone long, which is in this case, Aaron Sanchez, the big topic of debate. Should he start? Should he relieve? A lot of it was based on the fact that he just hadn't thrown that many innings. In your research, obviously, innings have not been the determining factor. Do you feel that this high-performance department could find a way or will be likely to look at ways to keep him on the field without looking at things like innings or pitch limits?
Yes. Like all the rhetoric that's come out of the high-performance department thus far has been really positive, and I'm encouraged by it. So basically, all of my research in the past has shown that using pitch counts and inning limits as like a blanket type of limit isn't effective. It's really individual and specific for each of the pitchers. And that's kind of the approach that it sounds like they're taking, where they're coming up with individual tailored programs, not just how much they pitch, but also how long and how they recover between pitching sessions. So that's not just the times they make appearances in games, but also side sessions, bullpen work, and type of stuff like that. So customizing those, their entire training package with recovery for each individual player is seems to be the key to keep a guy like Sanchez healthy, for example. And all of the rhetoric that's coming out of the department sounds like that's exactly what they're doing. So I'm very encouraged with what they're doing.
Cool.
So in that area, as far as tracking things and analyzing things like fatigue, we've seen with Marcus Stroman at Duke University, they talked about his sports bra looking like thing that was keeping track of that for him. But now a story came out today that the MLB has actually agreed to allow wearable biomechanical aids during the game to record what's going on during a game situation, which is kind of a breakthrough. Now, I understand you had been asked about these before. What do you know about these devices, and do you think that being able to use them is going to be something that teams are going to jump on, or it's going to be another slow process?
So you're referring to the Modus pitch sleeve, essentially. It's a commercially available product, and basically the pitcher wears it on their arm like a sleeve, and it's instrumented with a series of accelerometers. So essentially the same sort of things that are in your cell phone that tell you the orientation of your cell phone. So when you turn your cell phone to the side, your screen changes over. Those exact same types of sensors are in this sleeve. So what they can do is they can tell you not only the position of a pitcher's elbow, so flexion, extension, how they bend their elbow, as well as how fast they're moving it. So it's giving you a lot of useful biomechanical data in terms of if teams will actually use them and how they'll use them. I would not be surprised at all if the Jays are one of the teams that is using them, just based off of everything we've heard come out of their front office during the offseason. I know the Mets, with Sandy Alderson as their GM, they're probably definitely using them. They're probably one of the teams that, in my opinion, are the first ones to adopt this sort of technology. And I think more teams than you think are probably going to jump on board with this technology because it's relatively low cost relative to the team's payrolls and the budgets of their front offices. And it's relatively harmless as well. It's kind of inert, so there's not too much harm. The only issue is if the guys, the pitchers themselves, don't actually want to wear them because they think that it's going to affect their performance. Because with these guys, especially the players and the coaching staffs as well as the front office, they're going to care about performance more than injury prevention for the most part. So if for any reason the pitcher doesn't think he's going to perform as well, he won't wear them. But if the guys are willing to wear them, I think a lot of teams will jump on board with this.
I was actually just going to sort of touch on that. I mean, I'm just watching the Jays game as we're talking right now. I'm such a professional, so focused on what we're doing here. And you have a guy like Aaron Sanchez specifically. He pitches with short sleeves. And there are a lot of guys who don't ever wear long sleeves. And I'm sort of wondering if that's the kind of thing that's going to meet a lot of resistance more than people would probably assume. Is that something you think that is likely, or do you think that's just sort of going to be overblown?
Truthfully, I don't know is the answer. I would not be surprised if it did meet a lot of resistance from the performance perspective. And you're right, guys that don't wear long sleeves aren't going to want something on their arm. The other thing that is interesting with the news story that just got released about that today is the players union is someone else that's going to be interested, because having this data on pitchers that potentially could predict injuries or future career paths is very useful, but it's also fairly scary if you're a player, because you don't know exactly what the front office is going to do with the data. So one of the stipulations that I read is that the players have access to the data as well. So it's kind of trying to be a level playing field, but there could also be resistance in terms of the players not wanting to wear them just because they're concerned about how the data is going to get used.
And it might keep them off the field, maybe?
Yeah, or it could determine their career progression. So a front office could see something in a player's biomechanics, and that player was thought of, they were drafted as a starting pitcher, they want to be a starting pitcher, and they could see some sort of sign or signal in the data and that suggests maybe they should be used as a reliever type of player. So a guy that doesn't want to be a bullpen guy might end up getting pushed into that role because of this sleeve. So if I'm a pitcher and I want to be a starter, I might be one of those people that's hesitant to be willing to wear one of these.
So you're saying the Orioles will never be allowed to use this technology?
I'm going to have no comment on that one.
It's the only rule in the CBA. The Orioles have no access to any biomechanical live data.
Now, the Orioles done well though in terms of their recent history of injuries for their pitcher. They've got a good strength conditioning guy over there, so I think they're doing good as a department.
But they can't seem to graduate a successful pitcher. He might be healthy, but they seem to go to other teams and suddenly be successful. I know that's another department, but
that's a coaching and performance side of it.
So is this mix just going to get more complicated for teams to try and find the winning formula? I guess is what it comes right down to.
In the short term, yes. Anytime you have an influx of data like this is going to provide, it is going to get more complicated. But once teams start chugging through the data, noticing trends in it, learning from the data, I think it'll be a net benefit in the long run for sure.
Because there are no trends right now, right? Like, as this data comes in, there's no, we're going to compare this pitcher to this other successful pitcher from a year ago or 5 years ago, or we're going to compare this guy to a guy who got injured. It's really, it's like the PitchFX database in 2007. There's literally nothing.
Essentially, so there's a term called longitudinal studies in science, and basically the only way you get really good, convincing evidence is by doing a longitudinal study. So these are studies in the terms of years rather than days and months. And I think a front office, whether it's going to be formally or informally, they're going to run longitudinal studies, and they're going to track not only what the data they're getting out of the sensor, but then the associated outcomes. So if a player gets hurt or not, how they perform based off of their biomechanics. And then they're going to have to start making associations to try and figure out which of these markers or trends in the data are associated with certain outcomes. And that's going to take time to form these associations, find the associations, because you need a whole bunch of performance data to figure, or outcome data to figure out what's actually happening.
So I feel like we spent most of the time on, you know, things that aren't actually on the ball field. They're moving arms and parts and everything else. You went down to spring training this year, though.
That's correct. It was amazing.
I was going to say, have you, you were there for a week, you said, when we were talking, have you been to the spring facility before to take in a bunch of games or no?
When I was a kid, actually, my dad and I went down to Dunedin. It was ended up being an off day, so we couldn't get tickets, but it's a completely open facility, so we were able to kind of walk around the park. But this was the first time I had seen a series of games down there, and it's just a great experience. For anyone that hasn't gone, I strongly recommend it as a Jays fan.
As someone who was just down there as well, I totally second that.
Yeah.
So when you're watching the game, I wonder about this because I've had a few jobs in my life that I noticed after I've been doing the job for a while, I didn't experience those things the same way as an observer. You know, like when you learn to play a musical instrument, all of a sudden listening to the music is different. How do you watch a baseball game compared to back when you were a kid versus now? Do you find yourself thinking about the biomechanics or you know, what do you enjoy differently?
Truthfully, yeah, it's hard to watch it the same way after you start thinking about it in a certain way. So I do look at the biomechanics every time I see a pitcher throw a pitch, and some guys you can see and you're just like, hey, I would love to bring that guy into the lab, instrument him up, and actually do a full biomechanical assessment on him, because you see something that you think is interesting or maybe good or bad, but until you actually measure it, and that's the part that kills me, it's not being able to measure this stuff. So yeah, I'm still a huge Jays fan, like, so I'm not going to stop watching the games, but there are times when I'm watching it and I'm really frustrated by wanting to get in there and look at some data and do some analysis, but just not having the opportunity. Just as a side note, because Dunedin's kind of an open facility there, I saw like Angus Mugford and Clyde Brewer were just kind of standing around, and I had to resist the urge to go up to them just because I would appear to be just an absolute fanboy walking up. But it was in the middle of the game, and they're just kind of wandering around the concourse area, and you're just like, whoa, this is exciting and fun, but a little bit frustrating at the same time.
So what you're saying then is that you're actually the target market for all the booze, so you can turn that part of your brain off.
Yeah. Maybe that's a new strategy I should use when I'm watching the games.
They might be the least likely guys to get an autograph request, except for maybe you.
I don't know. That's the problem. I wouldn't actually go up to an autograph request. I'd probably just start having a verbal diarrhea and just sharing all my ideas and thoughts until they just thought I was crazy.
Yeah. Who is this guy? And why does he know I'm the head of what department?
Unless I suppose I could introduce myself. Hey, I'm Dr. Thomas Karakoulis. I have a PhD from the University of Waterloo, but I still think I'd come across as a little crazy unless I brought my degree with me.
I'm going to start doing that just to give you a bad name.
Is there anybody then when you're watching them that you actually think, how does he do that? As in, how does he throw that hard, or why doesn't he break down instantly? And is there anybody, again, you don't have real data, but is there anyone who you really want to drag in?
Well, the obvious answer is Tim Lincecum when you see him throw. It looks awful. But in terms of on the Jays specifically?
Sure.
Yeah, there's no one that I've seen on the Jays right now that I'd desperately want to bring into my motion capture lab to try and get some biomechanical data on them. With that being said, I was only there for a few days, so it's hard to see them up close and get a really good sense of how they look when they're pitching.
Yeah, you really do need, like you said, you need to measure things more than with the naked eye. And I think it's crazy that in 2016 we're still relying to a large extent on the naked eye to judge what a pitcher is doing or not doing.
Oh, so. Completely agree. But there's a lot of people that made their career on using their quote unquote expert opinion with their naked eye. So I'd be careful knocking that too much.
Exactly. Doesn't seem like it's ever going to go away.
All right. Well, I think that covers just about everything. We do thank you for stopping by again. And,
my pleasure. Anytime you guys want, I'm willing to be on.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll have you drop by during the season, not relating to an injury that already happened. Maybe something, you know, happier, like a big velocity jump or something else that someone's had.
As a fan, I'm hoping to not be on here again when one of the Jays starters goes down, because that would be awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, take me back to 2013. But let's not go there. All right. Thank you, Thomas. We will talk to you soon, and have a good night.
All right, you guys take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right.
And we are back. Thank you to Thomas for joining us once again. Very different than your typical sportscaster / media person guest. I like someone who has a different angle on the game.
Yeah, no, he's always good to talk to. He really knows his stuff too, which helps.
Totally. And I am fascinated by the idea that maybe pitchers will not always be breakable things that you just wait for bad news from, because that tends to be the way. Like Noah Syndergaard right now, I'm so scared for that guy.
You had to use him as your example.
Yeah, because he's the hardest throwing starter in baseball, not because he used to be a Blue Jay.
And he throws in the upper 90s on average.
Yeah, 99.
Yeah, 99 was his average.
95 mile an hour slider. Do you think that's stressful on the elbow?
No, not at all.
Oh, anyway, we had listener questions, a few of them this week. Maybe you were all watching games and not all of you had time to send in questions. But it was a night off when we solicited them.
They're
on
all
night
at Pitch
off.
Talks listening to Mark Shapiro.
That's probably true. There may be a significant number of Artificial Turf Wars listeners in that room right now, to which we say hello to all of you. All right, first question. Should Tulo's game glove have its own training staff?
Seriously. Well, he seems to have retired the glove, I think.
It came back out. One.
Oh, it did? Oh,
yep.
Geez.
It got repaired by a clubhouse attendant and came back out.
Like, the ball got stuck in it on one play, so it turned it out into a hit. And another ball, it kicked off it in a way that shouldn't have because the glove is too floppy. It cost the Jays two hits.
It went through the webbing. When he turned it in, it's because it went right through the webbing.
Oh, geez. So the one got stuck in the web and the other one went right through it.
Yeah.
Get a new glove.
It doesn't need, it does not need its own training staff. It needs its own pallbearers.
Thank you. I was going to make a similar joke.
It's the saddest thing ever. It's like, I really love this glove. It's dead, Jim.
Yeah. It's quirky, but time to go.
Yeah. Love it on a shelf or something. Okay. Well, we all agree on that because it just... Why would you play with something that hurt your game? Okay, do you know where the tradition of the ball tossed from the dugout to the first baseman returning at the end of an inning comes from?
It's from Colleen Evans.
Yes.
It's pretty simple, really. It's, you know, as you may have noticed, before the inning starts, the first baseman throws grounders to the infielders. It's just so that he has a ball when the inning starts, so he doesn't have to go looking for one. Same thing with the center fielder. Will have a ball thrown to him when he's coming in.
Yeah, so the ball gets tucked
or handed
in his glove
to him when he gets in the dugout.
Yeah, tucked in his glove, sits there, and then when he picks up his glove, he doesn't have to go hunting for one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's not true about the center fielder anymore. Now the bat boys just toss them one, but it used to be that way.
In the old days, when Josh played ball,
they'd walk 15 miles in the slow snow just to get to their gloves.
And all the balls were brown with dirt. We're allowed to use new ones.
Nice voice you got going there.
I'm regularly an old man, so that's just my older man voice. It's different. So we have two questions that also are more or less the same question. One from at the Mox Ball, which is Noel Moxon.
And I like that name for some reason.
It's kind of cool, kind of funky. And at Senzel 3000, Senzel. The first was, how long is Gibby's leash? When do you think they pull his plug if they don't get off to a good start? And then, is Gibbons still the manager of the Jays in April 2017?
You want to go for it?
Well, I think his leash is actually pretty long this year because the team played 500 baseball for a huge chunk of the season last year and then absolutely caught fire. With the exception of the 11-game winning streak in May, they actually hardly ever won three games in a row. So if they come out and do the same thing this year for some inexplicable reason, it's going to be kind of odd to go, well, last year this is how the team went, but now that it's doing it this year, we're going to fire him. It's weird. They'd have to be really, really awful. That said, do I think he's the Jays manager in 2017? I think that largely is dependent on whether they make the playoffs again and advance any further than the first round. I think he could lose his job over a poor performance somewhere at the end of the season much easier, because this regime is keeping him around because you can't really fire a guy that successful, can you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. If the team wins this year, he's going to be back. If they don't, he won't. I don't think it's even remotely more difficult than that.
Yeah, and to pull the plug on him earlier than that, they're going to get accused of just being way too quick on the trigger, I think. I don't think
they really will care that much, but I think you're right. It's just they know that he took this team to the ALCS last year, so there must be something there.
Exactly. So we will continue to talk about John Gibbons now, because John Gibbons, against possibly our better judgment, is going to get a do-over here.
Not for his on-the-field stuff.
No. For his way of expressing his disappointment post-game. First, I would like to note that John Gibbons knows how to censor himself, if he has to. Because during the post-game interview, which he knew was being broadcast live with a microphone in his face, he said, "I don't like it. It's..." And he paused a little bit, and he went, "It's crap." I'm like, ah, that word was probably not going to be crap.
Probably.
If you knew that if you'd forgotten you were on television. And then he went on to make some comments about the game being taken away and it losing, the sucking to lose that way. And then he decided to say that the Jays should maybe come in dresses tomorrow. I'm not even going to give him a do-over for that, because the media gave him a do-over for that. They came to him the next day and they said, "Would you like to clarify and or apologize for telling women that they are inferior to men, or implying that?" And he doubled down.
Yep.
Never double down.
He's like, "Oh, no, it's like people, I'm just trying to add levity to the situation." Fail, John.
Yep. And it's not about the people who know you and know what you're like, and it's not about the people who would get that humor or understand. It's not about any of those people. Those people exist. They're in your life, and they know you. And if you're going to make a statement like that, you make it to those people when only they are around, not to a reporter who puts a microphone in your face after you lost the game. And then, when you're given an opportunity that basically says, when nobody walks up to you about something non-controversial and goes, have you thought about it and want to apologize?
It'd be really funny if they did, actually. I'm going to start doing that in my everyday life.
Yeah, so you were late to work tomorrow. You were late to work yesterday. Do you want to apologize?
No. You showed up right on time for our meeting. Would you like to apologize for that? Just get to throw them really off guard.
So when they come to you, make an apology. That's what we do in this day and age. It doesn't fix it, but it at least shows you we're paying attention to the fact that the people you offended are not in your family or your friends. The people you offended are the people who count on you to represent this organization. And it's not hard to say that the thing I said indicated that women are, that wearing dresses and being female would be a bad thing to have to come do. And that means that women are a bad thing to be like.
Or weak.
Weak or whatever. There's a negative connotation. There was nothing positive about coming to the ballpark in dresses. It's bad enough when rookie hazings do it, which you notice they've sort of gotten away from it. We don't need the manager of the ball club to do it, and we need him to apologize and say that that is insensitive and pretty obviously insensitive to, I don't know, 50% of the people who watch baseball games. Okay, so here's your do-over, John.
Yeah, and I don't really have anything to add to that. I think you covered it pretty nicely.
Your do-over is the next. We gave you an opportunity to apologize. The media did. Apologize, and then we won't talk about this ever again. We wrote it.
If you're not going to apologize, at least acknowledge it's like, yeah, this probably wasn't a good idea.
Yeah, that was bad. I won't do it again. I shouldn't have done it that time. That wouldn't have been hard, would it? Okay. So on a lighter note, a cliche reared its ugly head. I believe Chris submitted this, but was unable to be.
No, it was
with
me.
It was you. You did submit it.
Yeah. During the game on Wednesday, Darwin Barney came up with a runner on first base, and immediately Buck and Tabby jumped in and said, "Oh, I think they're going to put a hit and run on." You know, Barney really handles the bat well.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah. So, the first thing, you go first. There's so many angles to take that from.
Okay.
It was your idea. I don't want to stop on it, but there's so many things I have to say about it.
It's go just, ahead. Okay. This concept of handling the bat well has come to mean doesn't strike out a lot. Which, in the context, it's like, yeah, this guy, he makes contact, would have been sense. But you'd think that a guy who handles the bat well would have a better career batting line than 245, 294, 339. So, do they just mean he has a nice grip and it looks proper?
He knows how to wiggle it. Look at that
if
wiggle.
If the ball hits it, he will not drop it. He's handling it well.
He's picked it up by the thin end, Pat. That's always what I imagine. When they get right down to it, the literal interpretation is the funniest to me. It's like he was early in his career, he was pretty much holding it in the middle. And it was a very awkward to swing because he kept hitting himself with the end of it. But now he handles the bat well. There was a time historically when handles the bat well meant and I think this was a long time ago, meant could put the ball to either left or right field with confidence, which is why you had your number
two
hitter.
There's a new name for that. That's a professional hitter.
Yes. Which is a different show. I think we did that one.
We did, yeah.
So, you know, we start off with guys who handle the bat well, which meant they had good command of how to deliver the baseball. They wouldn't be home run hitters because they had focused their skill set on doing something specific with pitches, inside outing the pitch or whatever else. Fine. Then there was a period of time where I don't know how, but handles the bat well meant he can bunt.
It still means that a little bit.
A little bit. But like, because nobody could bunt anymore.
But oddly, that's the one that makes the most sense because you're handling the bat differently when you bunt.
Yes. It's funny grip. That one where you don't crush your fingers if you make a mistake.
Yeah, that would be not handling the bat well.
He's very bad at handling the bat. Notice his broken fingers.
Very unambiguous system.
And I think, honestly, you were saying it comes to mean he doesn't strike out. I think it just means it's the very nicest way to say he's not a threat to hit. Period.
No, I think it's become guys who have no power but make contact. It's like, that's the context. It's like hit and run. Well, he handles the bat well. It's like, well, so he won't swing and miss.
Right, but of course, if he pulls the ball, the hit and run isn't really going to help. So you do need the actual traditional definition, where he needs to be able to aim it a little bit into that hole, or pick the pitch that is more likely to end up in that hole, or foul it off if he doesn't. I think, actually, fouling the pitch off is a skill that should have some sort of terminology associated with it, and doesn't. Some guys are really good at fouling a bunch of pitches off.
Till they get a good one.
Yeah. Making the pitch. And that is not, like, there's no term for that. He's not a, you know, he's a slugger if he hits it out all the time. What is if he can foul off more pitches than anybody else? He's a fouler?
Dexter?
Yeah. No, not him. Different. But in 100-odd years of baseball, we haven't come up with a term for a guy who's really good at fouling off pitches. Odd. But we know he probably handles the bat well.
Well done.
So, yeah, folks, everybody who got to the major leagues handles the bat well. That's not what Buck and Tabby are talking about. Do they know what they're talking about, Josh?
Not often.
And that's the sad, sad truth. Do you have a final thought for us?
I do. So, with this pitch talks that we referenced earlier, Mark Shapiro actually talked about the trade, the potential Michael Saunders, Jay Bruce trade. They said it was just about another year of control. So they're actually acknowledging now, it's not just a rumor as they claimed before. It was going to happen. And then Saunders apparently said to Atkins, it'll be the best trade they'd ever made. And then Jay Bruce has just hit 2 home runs today. But no.
Yeah, Michael Saunders looked fine.
Yeah, he did. But it's just very funny that they've gone from, you know, oh, it's just rumor. I don't know where these things come from to, yeah, it was happening.
It's strange. I'm going to talk about another traded player for my final thought. Drew Storen tweeted out last night, my first time in the six and just wow. And then, of course, someone asked him, wow, it's a great city, amazing, or wow, I can't believe it's still snowing up here, basically. Paraphrase. To which he eventually said, I probably should have put a thumbs up at the end of that first tweet to sort of indicate what the wow meant, which is pretty funny. But that's not the final thought. The thought is, folks, on Twitter, it is not necessary to join the massive chorus of people who are A, welcoming Drew Storen to Toronto, and B, apologizing for the snow and telling him it won't be that way forever. I'm pretty sure he's seen pictures of baseball games played in the summer here, and he understands that the snow is going to go away.
It'd be really funny if that wasn't the case, though. He's like, oh really?
It's going to snow forever. Also,
but the Twitter people let me know. I'm happy now.
Like, that's the most stereotypical Canadian thing to do. Welcome to our country. It's sorry, it's snowing, eh?
Typed A's.
Dozens of people. And it's like, do you not see the 6 other tweets responding to him with exactly the same thing? You could probably leave out the snow. It's okay. Yep. He'll get over it. So there we are. Another episode of Artificial Turf Wars in the bag.
Woo.
So you can reach Josh at Joshua Howsam. You can get Chris on the Twitter at CW Sherwin. You can follow me at Coolhead 2010. You can follow this podcast at Turf Pod. We would like to thank Thomas Karakolis for joining us and talking about biomechanics. As always, you have been Joshua Howsam. I have been Greg Wisniewski. Did I get through that without any major screw-ups?
You did.
That might be the first time.